Okay. We're going to call the Rules Committee to order today, and a little change of order from here. We have two representatives that have other meetings they have to go to, so we're going to open for a very short time, 29:41, to take the testimony of our two representatives, and then we're going to close that and go back to the regular order. So,
three.
Are you here for the same one or a different one?
Mr. Chair, I'm here for 72.
Okay, we'll see about that one. So, we're going to open a public hearing on 29:41. And with that, we'll just let you start your comment. We won't even do the introduction of the bill until later either. So, either of you, in whichever order you would like.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the courtesy of hearing this first so I can get to my other committee. For the record, I'm Chris Garrett, State Representative from House District 38, here to testify in support of House Bill 2941. This is one of three bills that I've introduced this session on the issue of reform of the initiative process. Two others have been scheduled for hearing next week, and I want to thank you for your courtesy in giving these bills a hearing. The increasing use and sometimes abuse of the initiative process in Oregon has spawned a great deal of discussion about the process, its effect on our state, and ways to improve it. Some of the most comprehensive analysis has been done by the City Club of Portland in two reports published first in 1996 and then again last year, making a series of recommendations ranging from relatively small fixes to transformational change of how we can improve the initiative process and make it work better for Oregon and more consistent with the purposes for which it was initially created. Today's bill, I think, falls somewhere in the middle of that spectrum with small fixes at one end and transformational change at the other. House Bill 2941 is aimed to stop the practice known as ballot title shopping. The title of a ballot measure has a lot to do with its chances for success or defeat at the polls, and for that reason, in recent years, a lot of gamesmanship has been introduced into the process of submitting petitions and qualifying them for the ballot. Petitioners have, in some cases, will submit as many as a dozen variations of the same proposal with very slight and non-substantive changes in wording for the purpose of seeing if they can generate different ballot titles for those alternative petitions and then select the most favorable title that they think will maximize their chances of electoral success. Just as one example, in 2006, a number of nearly identical sets of proposed initiative measures included 12 on school finance, 11 on minimum corporate taxes, 7 on land use, and 4 on property condemnation. And those numbers come from the 2008 City Club report. For the November 2008 election, as of September 2007, 133 initiatives had been proposed. Of that number, 45, more than one-third, were sponsored or co-sponsored by one individual. Ballot title shopping is not only a matter of gamesmanship by petitioners, it also comes at a significant cost to the taxpayers of the state. It creates administrative burdens on the Secretary of State, the Attorney General, and the Supreme Court, which is tasked with review of each petition challenge. So the purpose of this bill and the effect of this bill is to direct the Attorney General to issue the same ballot title to multiple initiative petitions if they are substantively identical in purpose, subject, and major effect. Currently, Oregon law actually disallows the Attorney General, under at least most circumstances, from assigning the same ballot title. This bill would simply repeal that statute and direct the Attorney General to, in fact, assign the same title to substantively identical ballot measures. I would urge your consideration. I thank you again for the courtesy of a hearing and your I vote.
Thank you. I think we'll hear from both of you and then we'll have some questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Nick Call, State Representative from House District 49. I'd like to thank you, first off, Mr. Chair, for letting us go first today. My take on this bill is a matter of initiative protection. I guess where I'd like to start just briefly, since Representative Garrett has covered very clearly the concerns. is just the importance of the initiative system to our form of government. In 1902, the citizens of the state of Oregon amended our Constitution to allow for the initiative process. This was the first amendment of our Constitution. To me, it's at the center of what it means to be an Oregonian and to be engaged in the electoral process. In our Constitution, in Article 4, where we define what the legislative department is and the legislative department does, the very first section of Article 4 defines the initiative and referendum process. Before the rules that govern this body, before our oaths of office are detailed, before our qualifications for office are even articulated, in Article 4 is the capacity for initiative and referendum and securing to the citizens of Oregon the right to have direct democracy. It is an important instrument, and like I said, it is at the core of who we are as Oregonians. And it is with that in mind that I'm here today to testify in support of this bill, because our process has been co-opted by people who want to utilize it for political gain rather than to allow for a free exchange of ideas. Whether or not you are in favor or opposed to any number of the contentious ballot measures that have come and gone in recent history, I think everybody has been well served by those ballot measure contests where we've had a full public airing of issues of very important concern. And to the extent that we can continue to have that public debate about important issues, I think this ballot measure will go a long ways towards making sure that this institution, the initiative process, is maintained for future generations. Just to reiterate just briefly, the Attorney General right now under ORS 250.035 subsection 6 is prohibited from issuing identical ballot titles. There is significant cost that goes along with this, and it allows people to co-opt this system that is so important to what we are and who we are as Oregonians. And I, with that, I'll close, and I'm happy to take your questions.
Thank you. Any questions for these witnesses? I just have one. The conversation that I've had has to do with who makes the decision as substantively the same, and is there a definition that would clearly articulate that for the person having to make that decision?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, under this bill, it would be for the Attorney General to make the determination whether two or more measures are substantively identical in purpose, effect, and purpose and effect. And I know that the Attorney General's office has expressed, I wouldn't say concern, but they have noted that that will be a matter for interpretation and that there could be disputes over their rulings on that question. I don't see a way around that. And I don't know if they have a representative here who may want to testify on that point, but that is a fact.
Okay. Any other questions? Seeing none, thank you both. And
thank you.
I hope that you have a great afternoon.
Thank you.
We're going to close the hearing on 2941 at this time, and we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2005. And we'll do a short staff summary, and then we have a lot of people who are willing to testify for this one, so hopefully people can keep that succinct.
Thank you, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. HB 2005 was up before the committee on Wednesday. Briefly, it requires the chief petitioner on a prospective petition for a state measure to file a statement declaring whether persons will be paid for obtaining elector signatures. Among other requirements, it requires paid signature gatherers to register with the Secretary of State and complete a training program that is for paid signature gatherers of prospective initiative petitions. Requires the Department of State Police to provide the Secretary of State with certain criminal background information on applicants. Directs the preparation of official templates for cover and signature sheets for prospective petitions for state measures, and requires the use of those official templates. Requires a chief petitioner to file signature sheets with the Secretary of State on a monthly basis. At the previous hearing, a variety of issues were discussed, the highlights of the measure, historical background of initiative legislation in Oregon and the use of the initiative process in other states, public perceptions and the need to restore confidence, proposed changes in knowledge requirement with regard to civil actions, constitutional issues, and the timing or effective date and its impact on petitioners currently gathering signatures.
Thank you very much. So, I think I will bring up Ted. We'll just go down the list. No one was more than 100 miles away. That was nice. So we'll go down. Ted, is it Lazada? I don't know.
Blazak,
thank you. Alice Bartlett? We'll just do two at a time so we have two microphones, and that will work.
Mr. Chairman, good afternoon. Should I start? My name's Ted Blazak. I own Democracy Resources. We're a signature gathering company in Portland, Oregon. For the past 10 years, our company has been gathering signatures on several ballot measures that you've seen on your ballot, such as raise minimum wage, protect Tillamook rainforests, and including Measure 26, which was a ballot measure that banned payment on a per-signature basis in the state of Oregon.
It's nice we're in the basement.
Maybe, Mr.
It all comes down on us.
Yeah, we're protected.
So I just had two main points that I wanted to bring up, and then I have some written testimony for you as well. Those are, one is that despite the passage of Measure 26 and IRMA last legislative session, criminal activity and signature gathering is still rather rampant in Oregon. And the second is that the reforms of House Bill 205 will not hamper the ability to put measures on the ballot in signature gathering. In terms of criminal activity that is still occurring right now, I myself have bared witness to things such as signature gatherers getting paid, dollar bills being peeled out behind the Greyhound bus station in Portland, homeless people being paid in beer and drugs for signature gathering. I've witnessed on several accounts the false witnessing of a petition sheet by a circulator. And this is primarily done because a pyramid scheme is in effect where the person who actually signs the petition as a circulator is not necessarily the person who did it, because they in turn are paying people on a per-signature basis. And the reason why these activities are still going on, despite the fact that y'all have passed legislation to stop this, is that the Secretary of State's office hasn't really been given the full tools they need to do the field investigation, nor an appropriate penalty out there to discourage chief petitioners and contractors from behaving in this activity. Essentially, the fines that are there now and have been handed out in the past are of very small amounts and do not discourage these folks compared to the value that these signatures have to them. The best thing about 205, in my view, is that it allows the Secretary of State's office to actually strike out signatures that have been gathered in illegal activity. So for that reason, I'm an avid supporter. The second thing I wanted to say is that if you're a company and you're gathering signatures and you pay by the hour and you follow the laws, like mine has over the last 8 years since we carried Measure 26, you have no problem following through with any of the added provisions of 2005. The only aspect of it that impacts the way our business functions on a daily basis is the monthly turn-in and submission of signatures. That's a little extra work for me, but there's a big advantage in that it allows us to get the signatures submitted to the Secretary of State's office So I don't have to worry about them being in my office in a file cabinet. Although it's locked and fireproof, I much prefer to see them in the Secretary of State's office. So thank you.
Thank you very much.
Hello, my name is Alice Bartelt, and I'm from Portland, Oregon, and I'm representing the American Association of University Women of Oregon. And I am just going to speak to Section 8 that talks about turning in signatures and starting the verification process ahead of time. I've been one of those people that has observed signature verification on Saturday afternoons in July and the heat, that kind of thing. And I really like the idea of being able to start verifying these signatures, because then you're not going to be paying people overtime to be there on the weekends to get this done within the time period that's now in the law. So it makes a lot of sense to be able to do that. And in addition, it would help the people carrying those positions, the people that are trying to get the signatures, because they'll know how many more they need at a certain point, because the way that it works now, if you turn in all your signatures on the deadline, you don't have any recourse to try to get any more. So it makes a lot of sense to pass this law, and we ask that you do so.
Thank you very much, and thanks. Oh, questions? Representative Girard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Blazak, how does a person who is hiring others to gather signatures, how is that person checked presently under current law?
Well, it's almost like any other occupation and any other employer-employee relationship. I hire employees, you know, I have ads in newspapers, folks come in, I interview them, I check their references. We also do criminal background checks, and then I decide whether or not this is someone that I want to hire. And then my employees are all hourly employees with managers, so they have a start of their shift, we have briefing meetings, we assign them to their location, then we have managers who visit them in the field after an extensive training period, which is much more intense. And then there's an end of the day where we have a debriefing and the collection of signatures. What frequently happens is why we have these paper signature operations still going on in our state is that some companies will operate with a weekly or monthly turn-in where you just submit your signatures and say, well, I've worked this many hours and I've gathered this many signatures. And that's what creates, in addition, these companies will have quotas, so if you have to have this many signatures per hour. So you will have the individual circulator has now incentive to either under-report or over-report the actual hours that they work, incentive to commit fraud, incentive to have other people circulate the petition in that pyramid scheme that I was discussing. And all that is would not be available if Measure 26 and IRMA was able to be properly enforced and the tools were there for the Secretary of State's office. And I think 2005 really does finally close these holes after 6 years.
Quick follow-up.
Yes.
So this, if we pass 2005, it's in essence not going to change the way you do business in signature gathering at all?
Yes, that's correct. The monthly turn-in is the only thing that's different, and that's not an added burden, nor is it that much of an added advantage.
Thank you.
Thank you to both of you. Kathy Eaton and Ross Day.
Good afternoon, members of the committee, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Kathy Eaton. I'm the governance coordinator for the League of Women Voters of Oregon, and I would remind you that the League is a nonpartisan grassroots political organization which encourages citizens to participate in government and to have informed participation in government. As a strong supporter of Oregon citizens' rights to direct democracy, The League of Women Voters of Oregon has advocated for protecting the initiative process from fraud and misuse for many years. The initiative was established in 1902 in order to address the corruption and the non-attention to the needs of Oregonians by the Oregon legislature. In the past two decades, we have seen the initiative process used more to promote ideologies than to enact laws considered necessary by a majority of the voters. The League supported passage of House Bill 2082 in 2007, which was a major improvement in several critical areas for the initiative system. And we support House Bill 2005, which would clarify and continue to protect the process. There are several pieces to this that we simply want to bring to your attention as important. Paid petitioners must register with the Secretary of State and receive training before any petitions can be passed, rather than waiting until 1,000 signatures have been gathered. The Elections Division may now start verifying the signature petitions when an estimated 50% of the number of qualified signatures has been reached, rather than a huge job of verifying them after the return deadline and before the date needed for ballot certification. And I think it's important to note that signatures of voters on the petition sheets are matters of public record, and we feel that that's very important. The official Secretary of State petition templates to cover and signature sheets, which will now be prepared for prospective petitions rather than after the 1,000 signatures have been gathered. We feel that's also a very important improvement to the current system. And chief petitioners would now file signature sheets each month, which would assist the Elections Division in initiative processing and more evenly spread the workload. There is a clear separation between paid and unpaid petition passers in this new 2005 bill that the chief petitioner must verify. The League believes that House Bill 2005 is an efficient and effective next step to improving the initiative process, and we urge the committee to pass it. Thank you.
Thank you. Ross.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For your record, Ross Day, Executive Director and General Counsel for Common Sense for Oregon. I'm also the owner of a petition circulation company called Voice of the Electorate, LLC, Vote Oregon, LLC. I'm also a veteran of many initiative petitions, being a chief petitioner on a number of measures, authored a couple of measures that have been passed by the voters. My point here is I know that of which I speak. Generally speaking, as it's currently written, we oppose House Bill 2005. There are some good things in there. The first thing that I think just makes sense, it's good government, is having the Secretary of State do the background checks, presumably because the Secretary of State has access to a broader criminal background database. It just seems to make sense to me. The early turn-ins, you heard Mr. Blazak talk about those. We generally like those. There are two concerns we have with them. One is a practical concern about how we turn those in, how does that affect the accounts that Irma required us to keep, and I'm sure we can probably work that out. But the other issue that we have a serious concern about is what's the true intent behind those particular provisions. If the intent is to make it easier for the Elections Division to catch up and certify these signatures, then there's no reason why information like validity rates, total signatures, and that kind of stuff should be made public. It's not now. Other than to the chief petitioner, there's no good public policy reason why that should be made public. If the real reason is to keep tabs on those measures that certain groups may not like to see whether or not they're going to have to fight them, well, I think that's an improper purpose, and it should not be a part of the measure. If you haven't gone and witnessed the signature verification process, the Elections Division does in that short amount of time is nothing short of a miracle. They're unbelievable. They're very professional. They do a fantastic job. If the point is to give them more time to do their job, I'm all for it. But I just am concerned about the real reasons behind that particular portion of the bill. But frankly, there's a lot of this bill that is just flat unconstitutional. There's no two ways about it. There was a question posed to the Secretary on Wednesday about, well, is this retroactive? Well, as the bill is currently written, yes. There are measures out there that are circulating. There's one measure that's actually qualified, and I believe they're actually they've got the ballot title. They've gone through the process. This measure would apply to them, would make them go through the process again. In essence, it would raise, for reasons in my letter, would raise the number of signatures they'd need to qualify the measure for the ballot, which would directly violate Article 4, Section 1 of the Constitution. The part about there's the section says I can be a paid petition gatherer, a circulator, or a volunteer, but not both. That's like saying that you as a legislator can either be a legislator or a chief petitioner, but not both. It's ridiculous. It's like telling me that I can paint houses. I can either paint houses as a profession, or I can paint them on the weekends with my buddies, but I can't do both. That is fundamentally unconstitutional. That's one of the ones that's an easy win, I think. There are other provisions that's in my letter that outlines, you know, the constitutional concerns that I have with House Bill 2005. I wanted to address, if I could briefly, some of the questions that were raised on Wednesday, and then maybe make some suggestions to 2005 that we'd like to see that I think are that would make the process overall work a lot more efficiently for everybody. First, Ms. Olney represented to the committee that the Preddy case, Preddy versus Bradbury, held that Measure 26 was constitutional. That's fundamentally wrong. Footnote 6, I believe, of the Preddy case, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, and I'm the lawyer who represented the Preddys, said that they did not find that that case did not say that Measure 26 was constitutional. That is still an open question. The Sixth Circuit in the Dieters case recently held that a ban on paper signature was unconstitutional. That's the most recent case to decide the issue. So you need to keep that in mind as you move forward. Further, the registration and ID badge requirements of IRMA were specifically held unconstitutional in the Buckley case. That's a case out of Colorado by the U.S. Supreme Court. There is a case, Walker versus Elections Division, where that question is before the court. That's what I've been working on this week, is that brief. A briefing is due on Monday. Ms. Olney said, well, we haven't won at any stage. We haven't won at the preliminary injunction stages because we haven't been able to show irreparable harm. That's one of the two. You have to show likelihood of success or irreparable harm. We weren't able to show irreparable harm. So we're still moving forward on that, and that is still an open question. There is a question about the should-have-known standard. What is that? In the area of vicarious liability, that's called deliberate indifference is the standard. However, that is a standard that applies to an employee-employer principal-agent relationship. What we have in the context of Section 5, I believe it is, of 2005, is something far greater than that. The example I use is the painting contractor. I hire somebody to paint my house. He hires an employee to help him. You would hold the employer liable for any of the bad acts, the tortious acts that the employee commits, but you wouldn't hold the property owner liable. Well, that's what Section 5 does. Section 5 goes further than what the ordinary doctrine of respondeat superior, or criminal respondeat superior, goes and holds the chief petitioner liable for something you should have known, which quite frankly is vague on its face. What does should have known mean? When do I know when I should have known whether or not I'm aware of a potential violation? That I think is unconstitutionally vague, but there's also I think it also conflicts with that particular portion of the statute that's being amended allows chief petitioners 24 hours, or I think it's one business day, to report the potential violation. Well, how do I know when I should have known of the potential violation, how do I take advantage of the 24-hour, I guess, get-out-of-jail-free clock? I think that's something that needs to be addressed. I'll go real quickly here. Again, we talked about the rolling turn-ins and the logistical problems with that. I think if the idea here is to figure out, okay, what signatures are valid and which ones aren't, I don't know why we don't allow people who've signed a petition to sign an affidavit if their signature gets thrown out, saying, yeah, that is my signature. That only seems to make sense to me. Why not allow chief petitioners to sign one blanket statement certifying that a list of petition circulators are all authorized to circulate a petition on their behalf instead of having to do one at a time? Why not allow electronic filing of a lot of this stuff, like what we do with our current campaign finance laws as well? Last is allowing chief petitioners to use maybe a power of attorney or something of that nature to allow folks to act as their agent on their behalf. I think that would certainly streamline the process a lot as well. So, in conclusion, if there's, I look forward to working with the committee and whatever groups also may be forming on this. This is a very important issue to me. It's pretty much what I've dedicated my professional career to, and I hope that we can work something out that's going to be fair for everybody. So, thank you.
Any questions for these witnesses? Representative Girard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Day, there's another bill in this House to approve registering to vote online. Do you see that as a problem with the correlation between someone signing a petition and on the same day, either before or after signing the petition, registers to vote? How do we determine whether that person was a registered voter at the time they signed the petition?
Mr. Chair, Representative Girard, that's a good question. I don't know how that would work. As it currently stands, if somebody were to register, as I understand it, if I register to vote today and then I sign a petition today, my signature counts. Even if I sign the petition at 11 and sign the registration card at 1, it still counts. But in the instance where what you're talking about, I'm not sure how the Elections Division would make that work. And I think that the electronic registration bill suggests, I think it certainly suggests support for allowing people to sign petitions electronically. I mean, if we're willing to let people register to vote, the most important thing we can do as citizens, it seems to me that the Lemons case said your signature isn't nearly as important as your vote. Well, if that's the case, then why not allow people to sign petitions online? Why not? I mean, our validity rates will be a lot higher. Talk about eliminating fraud. That'll get a lot of the concerns that Mr. Blazak talked about out of the way. Why not allow that as well? Something that I think the committee should consider.
Other questions? There probably will be some as time goes on. But thank you both.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Steve Berman and Dan Meek.
Chair Roblin and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of House Bill 2005. For the record, my name is Stephen Berman, and I am here representing Our Oregon. Our Oregon is a statewide nonprofit that advocates for tax and economic fairness. As part of our mission, Our Oregon also works to protect the integrity of the initiative system. We have played an active role in monitoring the financing and circulation of initiative petitions to ensure that there is transparency and integrity in the process. Our Oregon supports House Bill 2005. It is a reasoned and reasonable bill that will protect the integrity of the initiative process while ensuring that Oregonians are able to qualify citizen initiatives for the ballot. I have provided the committee with written testimony, which I won't fully reiterate, but there are some highlights I want to address. On Wednesday, Secretary Brown and the Attorney General's office discussed some of the history of abuse and fraud that has become an unfortunate part of the signature collection process. Oregon voters overwhelmingly showed their disapproval for the abuses of the initiative system when over 75% of them voted yes on Measure 26 in 2002. Measure 26 prohibits paying signature circulators by the signature, a process which encouraged forgery and other fraudulent practices. Measure 26 also gave extensive worker protections to circulators. Last session, the legislature passed HB House Bill 2082, the Initiative Reform Modernization Act, or IRMA, which provided for implementation and enforcement of Measure 26. IRMA also provided the Secretary of State with additional tools to monitor ongoing signature collection on initiative petitions and to prevent fraud, forgery, and other abuses. House Bill 2005 will fill some of the important gaps that unfortunately were left open by IRMA. House Bill 2005 makes 7 adjustments to the current statutory scheme. I want to highlight a few of them, the first being the discussion that we've already heard about registration and training for paid petition circulators through all steps of the process. Through a gap, or a drafting glitch in IRMA, the first 1,000 signatures, called the sponsorship signatures, simply don't have any of the safeguards that are applied to all the other signatures in the initiative process. So the circulator registration requirement, the chief petitioner identification, the circulator training, all those safeguards simply don't apply to the first 1,000 signatures. And this bill corrects that hole. With sponsorship signatures, there actually is a real and extant problem. There has been a history in the past of detailed fraud and forgery in qualifying measures. This started back in 2000 when forged signatures were submitted for the sponsorship petitions for measures 92 and 98. 11 initiatives this cycle, since IRMA went into effect, have already had their 1,000 signatures verified, and most of those had up to 2,000 signatures submitted in support. So we're already talking about somewhere in the range of 22,000 to 24,000 signatures that have been circulated. Signatures count towards the total number needed, but the circulators have not been registered. There's been no monitoring. There's been no campaign finance observations of these folks. This is simply a hole that it is important to fill. The third aspect of this, and why we need to get to the beginning of the process, is in the Lemons versus Bradbury case, the Ninth Circuit upheld Oregon's current scheme for verifying signatures, but the Ninth Circuit emphasized repeatedly that one of the reasons it was doing it was because there was full transparency in Oregon's system from the start to the finish. And if we have the first run of signatures, the financing that goes on with those, with no training and no transparency, we lose that protection and possibly the whole functioning of our system. So it's a gap that needs to be addressed and should be filled as quickly as possible. I want to talk a little bit as well about the changes the bill does, where it now allows concurrent civil and criminal enforcement at the same time. This was something that Margaret Olney discussed on behalf of the Attorney General and talked about the frustration that the Attorney General's office was experiencing, because if there was an election law violation that has a criminal aspect to it, that gets sent over to the Attorney General's office. It's treated as a full criminal complaint, and a lot of time is spent pursuing that complaint, whereas if it were a civil matter, the Secretary of State's office could handle it faster, less expensively, and more expediently. Another example, in the last initiative cycle, initiative petitions 51 and 53 were actually suspended from circulation by the Secretary of State's office. They were suspended because the chief petitioners had not complied with some of the reporting requirements of IRMA and had destroyed certain documents they were required to keep. Nonetheless, these petitions continued to be circulated. There were circulators out there circulating petitions that had been suspended. It got to the point where actual members of the Elections Division were approached by circulators and were asked to sign the petitions that the Secretary of State's office had suspended. This matter had been sent over to the Attorney General's office for a full criminal investigation because some of the violations were criminal. The Secretary of State's office's hands were tied to stop this behavior from happening. So this concurrent enforcement is very important for giving people the real tools and the real time to do enforcement. We should have known liability for chief petitioners, contractors, and subcontractors. This is a common law legal standard for willful violations of the law. It's the same standard applied to a whole range of individuals, from lawyers to doctors to mortgage brokers, to ensure that they comply with the law. This is a standard applied in the Unfair Trade Practices Act. There is no reason that chief petitioners should be treated differently. This is, in fact, the same standard that's applied, as Mr. Day pointed out, to employers supervising their employees. Petition circulators under Measure 26 are employees of the circulation firms that hire them. This will prevent what we've come to call ostrich behavior. Chief petitioners and petition circulating firms sticking their head in the sand and not paying attention to what their circulators are doing and what their subcontractors are doing. And again, we could go through examples in the last election cycle with Initiative Petition 20. There were at least three declarations that were filed by people saying, I did not sign this petition. I do not sign petitions. I did not sign it, but my signature is on it. And under the current law, the firms that hire the circulators and the chief petitioners, if they just make themselves willfully ignorant of what's going on, there's no liability that runs up to them. So this is a correction that exists in a whole other area of law, both civil and criminal, and we're just bringing it, Secretary, I'd like to bring it up to speed. I think the other parts, rolling turn-in, obviously, right now, under the Constitution, signatures have to be submitted no later than 150 days before the election and then have to be counted within 30 days. This provision would give the Secretary of State more time to verify signatures as they come in, allow much better monitoring for Measure 26 compliance purposes, and reduce the budgetary and resource drain on the Secretary of State's office when they have to ramp up when you have nine petitions submitted on or about July 3rd or July 4th and everything has to be counted by August 4th. That's just a recipe for doing verification carefully and properly. I think with that, I'll be available for questions, but I'll stop my comments there.
Thank you very much. Mr. Meek.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wonder why my mouth always goes dry when I have to speak. But my name is Dan Meek. I represent a variety of public interest groups who have used the initiative process since 1978. I think we first have to understand that there is an inherent tension between the legislature and the users of the initiative process. The users of the initiative process are out to enact laws or amend the Constitution in ways that the legislature will not. That's really the purpose of the initiative process. For example, Oregon voters, using the initiative process, have four times enacted limits on campaign contributions in Oregon since 1908. The legislature has never done that. So there is an inherent tension. I believe that House Bill 2005 continues what I would call the de-grassrootsification of the initiative process, basically turning it over to paid professionals only and making it difficult or impossible for amateur groups that don't have election lawyers and don't have and can't afford to hire paid circulating firms to ever put a measure on the ballot. Now, back in the 1980s, I was involved in several campaigns where groups of dedicated volunteers, sometimes also using paid circulators, were able to place measures on the statewide ballot after raising and spending as little as $20,000. Today, because of the constant ratcheting up and complication of the rules, that's probably not a word, it now costs at least $400,000 to place a similar measure on the statewide ballot. This is why grassroots organizations can no longer do it. In the year 2000, for example, there were 9 progressive measures on the Oregon statewide ballot. Of course, I'm a progressive guy. Those are the ones that I count. In the year 2008, there were 0. And I believe with the continued complication of the initiative process, we will continue to see 0 grassroots measures on the statewide ballot. Just one example, and you've heard a lot about how Oregon's initiative process is so open. Well, it isn't. Let me give you just one example. In the last couple of election cycles, I've seen the Oregon Secretary of State's office disqualify what I would count as at least 200,000 valid voter signatures on statewide measures because of alleged errors made by circulators. Like the circulator might have tried to correct a date on the circulator's own signature, that sort of thing. State of Washington, on the other hand, now is the state of Washington, is their initiative process corrupted by fraud? Is it just everything goes up in the state of Washington? State of Washington, you can submit signatures, and you don't even have to have, the circulator doesn't even have to sign the petition at all. There was no place for the circulator to sign the petition until a couple of years ago when they put a signature block on the back of the petition, back of the signature sheet. But even if the circulator doesn't sign the signature sheet, the valid voter signatures count. And that's something we've gotten away from in Oregon. We punish voters for signing petitions because of the alleged or real or imagined misbehavior of petition circulators. Now, there are good solutions for this problem. Hasso Herring, the editor of the Albany Statesman Journal, in an editorial earlier this week, suggested that we have online petition signing. Of course, this committee and the House very recently passed the bill, HB 2386, to allow online voter registration. I have a letter here from the Secretary of State, dated March 20th of this year, that states that the online system can be extremely secure. I believe Oregon's online system will be every bit as secure as the current system. And there's no reason that I can think of not to use that to make signature sheets, to make signing of petitions available to voters as well. Just bypass all of this street warfare that we're talking about. In addition, for several years, I've advocated what I've called the initiative primary, which is that if you collect a fewer number of signatures, not anything close to the 100,000 or so that is required now, and because of all of these new complications, you really need to submit at least 50 or 60% more than the nominal amount in order to qualify. With a fewer number of signatures, a measure would qualify to be placed in the primary election voters pamphlet and on the primary election ballot, and voters can fill in the oval if they want to sign a particular measure. And measures that receive a sufficient number of such signatures can go on the general election ballot. It might be a greater number of signatures than it is now because this process will make it easier for voters to sign petitions. So the barriers can be overcome to make the initiative process, again, available to grassroots organizations in Oregon. House Bill 2005 doesn't do this. Most of the provisions of this bill appear to be innocuous, but let me place them in context for you. Just 2 of the provisions that appear to be innocuous. But first, a comment about the provision that says that if you have been subject to any fine for an election law violation, then you're permanently disbarred from collecting signatures. And that it doesn't matter whether you're paid or not. That section of the bill bans you. It's a lifetime ban from collecting signatures if you've ever been fined for an election law violation. The Secretary of State's office testified here 2 days ago that those violations don't include campaign finance violations. But in fact, they do. They include many campaign finance violations because there are only 2 types of violations that would be exempt from that statute, and those 2 types of violations are defined under ORS 260.232, failure to file a statement or certificate required to be filed, or failure to include in a statement the information required. There are a lot of other kind of campaign finance violations that are not covered by that penalty, which means they are covered by the penalty under ORS 260.995, which means if you violate that or are subject to those penalties or have been subject to those penalties any time in your life, you have a lifetime ban against collecting signatures on an initiative or referendum. I got a table of those folks who have been violated by this thing, and I would say the mode profession, that is the profession most often represented by those folks, is school superintendent. Because those folks have to defend themselves against claims that they have used public money in an election campaign, usually for school bond measures. So if you leave the statute the way it is now, we will have lots of school superintendents who are permanently disqualified from collecting signatures. I don't think that's the intent. The intent is that campaign finance reporting violations don't count. That should be made explicit in the bill and not be left the way it is now. But let's go to those two innocuous provisions. First, the provision for changing the vicarious liability imposed upon a chief petitioner from the petitioner did have knowledge of the violation by the circulator, for example, to the chief petitioner should have had knowledge. Well, that sounds fairly innocuous. You know, you should have at least some involvement in the process, and you should have knowledge of violations of election law by the circulators. But let's examine how this would happen in practice. I think in practice what this would do is be extremely helpful to opponents of any ballot measure to be able to derail the measure and nullify all voter signatures on the measure, even if the measure has enough voter signatures to qualify for the ballot but has yet to be verified. Because you can use this new provision to persuade what I would call amateur chief petitioners to abandon their measures or to take themselves off of the measures. I can just see it happen. Chief petitioners, let's say you've got chief petitioners who are not paid political professionals. Someone can call up under this provision, someone can call up a chief petitioner and say, well, you know something? Under this new law that was just passed, you can be subject to a penalty of 5 years in prison or a $125,000 fine if any circulator violates any of the dozens of laws and rules about circulating petitions, even if you don't know about the violation. Because you should have known. You have this vague standard, should have known. Faced with that, I would say probably a large percentage of amateur chief petitioners would be frightened and would say, well, I don't want to do that. I don't want to go to prison. I don't want to have my life savings removed from me. What can I do? Well, you can just withdraw as a chief petitioner. What's the consequence of that? Let's say you've got three chief petitioners and one of them wants to withdraw. You've already collected 90,000 signatures. What's the consequence of one chief petitioner withdrawing? According to the Secretary of State, the legal consequence is the entire petition is permanently dead and all of the signatures don't count. Okay? So, if you want to change the standard to should have known, that's fine with me, but let's then also change the way the initiative process works so that the intimidation of a single chief petitioner cannot nullify the efforts of hundreds or thousands of people stretching over 1 or 2 years. And that, I believe, would be the consequence of this change. Here's another innocuous provision, the monthly turn-ins. By the way, if anyone wants to have an early count to know how many signatures they still need to collect, they can simply turn in early now at any time. And the Secretary of State then counts the signatures and tells them how many they have left to go. So that's not a problem. Monthly turn-ins. Now, what possibly could be wrong with monthly turn-ins? Well, the Secretary of State, as you heard on Wednesday, says that all the signature sheets that are turned in become public record at the time they're turned in. What will happen with these sheets then? Well, it's what has happened in the past when folks have done early turn-ins, and that is opponents of the measure will get the sheets and start making phone calls, thousands of phone calls. They'll get a phone database, match it against the name and address records of the signers of the petition, start making calls. Do you remember signing this petition about, you know, parental notification? Do you remember signing this petition about eliminating the kicker? Now, if you call enough thousands of people, inevitably you will find some folks who don't remember that they signed the petition. Oh, my God, fraud, forgery. And then the opponents of the petition will then charge the circulators with fraud, forgery, any number of other violations. That might not be so bad if there was a process for quickly resolving such matters, but there isn't. There is no deadline on the Secretary of State to handle these matters. The chief petitioners of some of the measures I have been involved in have complaints against them that have been outstanding for more than 3 years, even though they could have been easily resolved. For example, some of the chief petitioners on one measure, all the chief petitioners were accused of paying per signature because they hired this firm called Arno to go collect signatures, and Arno paid per signature. So they immediately responded to the claim by pointing out that they never hired Arno. They don't know Arno. They have no signatures from Arno. They have nothing to do with Arno. Okay, that answer was given to the Secretary of State in the spring of 2006, and it's 3 years later, and it's still not resolved. Of course, in the meantime, through the rest of the campaign, the opponents of the measure say, these chief petitioners are under investigation for violation of state election law. Well, right, and they're still under investigation. They're still subject to that kind of smear because the Secretary of State's office doesn't resolve complaints on a timely basis. So if you want to have monthly turn-ins, that's fine with me, too, as long as those, let's just keep the signatures and the signature sheets confidential until the measure is qualified for the ballot. So it will not allow this kind of what I would call data mining for phony fraud to occur. Let's put it in the context of a legislator. Let's just imagine for a moment that votes in an election were public record. And so someone could take the votes, votes for you in an election, start calling the people. Do you remember voting for this Arne Roblin guy? Inevitably, some people say, no, I don't remember that. Ah, voter fraud. And not only that, let's use the process in House Bill 2005, and let's make Arne Roblin personally responsible for that because he should have known that there was voter fraud going on. So innocuous provisions can have very devastating effects, and they should not be adopted by themselves without considering those effects and without similarly changing the law to eliminate the effects that, in essence, would destroy the initiative process for any kind of non-professional operation, because it allows the opponents of the measure basically to intimidate amateurs out of the process. That's what this would allow to do. Just a couple of responses to Ted Blazak. He says some people are paid in beer or drugs. Well, that's illegal already. What does House Bill 2005 have to do with that? Nothing. He says, well, there aren't appropriate penalties now. Well, the penalties for violating laws about circulating petitions is $125,000 or 5 years in prison. And, of course, this bill doesn't change the penalties. And finally, he says that House Bill 2005 allows the Secretary of State to strike signatures collected by illegal activity. Well, sorry, that's already existing law. It's called House Bill 2082 that was passed 2 years ago. 2005 doesn't change that except that it says that signatures collected by anyone who any time in his or her lifetime has been fined for any number of campaign law violations, including many campaign finance reporting violations, those signatures can't be counted either. So on the whole, I think the initiative process needs reform, but it needs reform in the direction of making it available to, and not even the average person, it's not even available to highly civically engaged amateurs now. It's become a completely professional process, and I think that is, that's a shame. The initiative process should be available to the average person. You shouldn't have to raise $500,000 to fight and fight through, legal minefields for 2 years in order to put a measure on the ballot just to allow people to vote on it. Thank you.
Representative Garrard.
Mr. Meek, is it possible to do that? Can you make initiative laws simple enough for the average citizen that's going to avoid the abuse that will come with that from more professional petition gatherers?
Representative Garrard, I'm not sure I understand your question.
Okay, can we do what you want to do?
Yes.
Make petition gathering simple enough for the average person, but yet avoid abuse by others.
Absolutely. I would think that placing measures after collecting a threshold number of signatures, placing them on the primary election ballot for people. So on your election ballot, you'd see the ballot title, which is an objective ballot title. At least on initiatives, they're objective. They are not produced by one side or the other. They're produced by the Attorney General and subject to judicial review. Of course, another problem is the fact that judicial review of ballot titles in Oregon can often destroy the opportunity to place any measure on the ballot because there's no deadline there either. Sometimes the Supreme Court takes seven or eight months to decide a ballot title challenge, and that's another way of just keeping everything off the ballot. Sure, that's one way to do it. Put the ballot title and even the explanatory statement or in the voter's pamphlet of the primary election and let people sign petitions by filling in the oval, just like they nominate people for public office to the from the primary to the general election. I think electronic or online signature collection should be allowed. I know that there's at least one political party in Oregon that already does that for internal party elections. It can be secure, and you know it's the society changes, and there have been changes that have affected the initiative process that have nothing to do specifically with what this legislature has done. Some of it has to do with the Supreme Court. The Oregon Supreme Court in 2000 reversed decades of its own precedents and decided that petitioners have no right to be in the common areas of shopping centers or in parking lots of big box stores. That makes the process much more difficult. And there's now a large and legitimate concern in society about identity theft. I think someone testified, or there was some comment about the bill for electronic voter registration, where someone said that your ability to register to vote should not depend upon your happening to run into a crackhead in Pioneer Square. That is, it has now become, I think, a risky venture to sign a petition and you provide your signature to a stranger. And if we I think I've tried to answer your question.
All I was looking for, Mr. Chair, was a yes or no.
Any further questions of these witnesses? Seeing none, thank you both.
Thank you.
Andy Miller and Jim Welsh.
Good afternoon, Chair Roblin and Committee. For the record, my name is Andy Miller, Senior Policy Analyst for Oregon Business Association. Oregon Business Association advocates for enhancement of Oregon's business environment and quality of life, providing bipartisan statewide business leadership that strives to ensure Oregon's long-term prosperity. This isn't in my written testimony, but a lot of people say, why in the world are you interested in this? OBA does its policy work through committees. We are our policy objectives come from our members, so we're a member-driven organization. A lot of folks in our organization are truly what I call good government junkies, and the Good Government Committee identified the initiative and the process of the initiative as one of the things they wanted to study in the interim, and we did significant research in conjunction with the City Club and others to come to our positions. So that's kind of why we're here. Good government practices are the foundation for good public policy. OBA believes that good government is dependent not only upon public officials who are dedicated to the public interest, but also in processes that are equitable, transparent, and accountable. We respect the citizens' right to petition their government when the legislature is unable or unwilling to act on critical issues. We also respect representative democracy and the right of the legislature to be the state's principal means to lawmaking. The current initiative system is flawed, resulting in potentially harmful public policy and costing the state significant revenues. Our goal is to restore integrity to the initiative process so that it's transparent, accessible, and works as it was originally intended, while protecting it from potential abuses and harmful unintended consequences. Recent polling that we were a part of showed that voters no longer believe Oregon's initiative system is sacrosanct. Nearly three-quarters want changes made. OBA has organized a coalition of business, labor, City Club of Portland members, advocates, and the governor's office to consider what changes should be made. The signature gathering phase of Oregon's initiatives has been fraught with violations, including illegal payments and forged signatures. This is one of the areas of the process where we feel changes are necessary and appropriate. House Bill 2005 continues the work begun in 2007 by seeking avenues to reduce fraud in the signature gathering process. OBA supports the Secretary of State's efforts. We also support additional financial and personnel resources to vigorously and proactively enforce regulations governing signature gathering. I realize that you all aren't Ways and Means, but I promise to say that every time I'm up here, because we have great laws on the books with Irma and 2005, and a lot of good stuff is going to be coming at you the next couple of meetings. And in order to do that, we have to make sure that the Secretary of State's office has the resources to deal with this very critical piece. If we allow it to continue and say we have other budget priorities, which we do have many, we will perpetrate the cycle of some of the problems that we've had from the initiative. And I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you. We'll go ahead.
Mr. Chair and committee members, Jim Welsh here representing Oregon Taxpayers Association and the Oregon State Grange. Both organizations get very, very nervous when we see this many pieces of legislation addressing the initiative and referendum process. And they would be no matter what party was in majority. It's just something that it just is a big red flag to them. And so I have had plenty of experience with Ross Day and Dan Meek. And I think what they mentioned and some of the things that you should be cautious about should be well taken by the committee, because these guys have had, I would call them the experts. I am certainly not, but my organization's, the Oregon State Grange had long, long history around the initiative process and helped bring it to the state. And I would remind the committee that anything we do needs to any amendments need to augment the people's process. Because until they vote this out, the initiative and referendum process, until the people of this state say, we don't want it anymore, it is their process. And so what I would say that, talking to them, that they would want a process that they could engage in without bringing their attorney, without having millions of dollars of liability insurance to cover them, and to make sure that those who sign on and to in agreement would be honored through the process. Yes, we have to have some cautions in there for against fraud. There's no doubt about that, but it needs to be a process they can easily navigate and one that represents the people. And so with that, I will close.
Any questions for these two? Thank you both.
Not representing the garage.
I know.
My feelings are hurt.
And the last two on this bill, Sal Peralta and Kathy, is it Jackson?
A distinguished chair, honorable representatives, for the record, my name is Sal Peralta. I'm president of Vanguard Campaigns, a political consulting firm that collected most of the signatures to put Measure 65 on the ballot in 2008. To the best of my knowledge, my firm was the only firm to work on signature gathering entirely under the rules promulgated by House Bill 2082. The Secretary of State testified on Wednesday that House Bill 2082 2005 is an extension of House Bill 2082 from the 2007 legislative session, which is now known as IRMA, the Initiative Referendum and Modernization Act. As someone who uses the initiative process professionally or has used it professionally, I'm a strong supporter of IRMA and of the efforts of the Secretary of State to clean up Oregon's initiative process. Although it is true that the costs of circulating initiative petitions has increased under the rules promulgated by IRMA and by ballot measure 26, I believe that's a small and reasonable price to pay to help ensure the integrity of the Oregon system. I'm going to deviate just really briefly from my prepared remarks. I would like to say that I'm very sympathetic to the people who have come up and testified that the process has become thoroughly professionalized, that it is no longer open to the average citizen. And I would encourage you to consider rules in this session or in future sessions to open up that process to the average citizen as opposed to having it be paid circulators of the sort that my company would employ. I generally agree with the analysis given by Margaret Olney at Wednesday's hearing regarding the basic provisions of House Bill 2005. I believe that this bill is worthy of support, provided that a few important tweaks are included to help further ensure the integrity of the process by safeguarding the rights of electors who sign initiative petitions and the chief petitioners who bear significant financial cost and legal liability in the circulation of initiative petitions here in Oregon. I'm going to address a few specific sections of the bill that that I support and some that I have some concerns about. Sections 1, 3, 4, and 7 primarily serve the purpose of extending rules that are already in place for the circulation of initiative petitions to the circulation of prospective petitions. I believe this is a logical step and that these changes will have very little effect on a company that uses an employee-based model in the hiring of circulators and whose primary defense against charges of fraud or such concerns is total transparency in accounting and work product, both of which I believe are rewarded under the new rules promulgated by IRMA. Section 2 extends the training, identification, and registration requirements for carrying initiative petitions to prospective petitions and extends the window for processing applications from 3 days to 5 days so the Secretary of State can conduct a criminal background check on prospective employees. I believe this is an excellent provision. One of the biggest challenges we faced in gathering signatures for Measure 65 was in the handling of criminal background checks for prospective employees. The Oregon State Police takes about 10 days to respond to these requests from employers. My understanding is the Secretary of State will address these concerns within a 5-day window, and I'd like to thank the Secretary of State for ensuring those background checks are only conducted the first time someone registers with the state during a given election cycle. I think that makes sense. The other issue that we have in the registration of employees is that it lengthens the amount of time it takes to put an employee out and makes them available to work. These folks that we hire tend to be low-income people. And I think in many cases a week or 2 weeks to get them through the process and registered can be very burdensome. So I would encourage anything that would allow us to put people to work, especially in the current economic climate. Sections 5 and 6 modify the liability for chief petitioners from has knowledge to should have had knowledge of violations by employees or contractors. The Secretary of State and Attorney General testified that this is intended to address instances where a petitioner willfully turns a blind eye to potential violations. If it's limited in scope to those actual violations, I would have no problem with this, but I would warn that this provision could be abused by an overly aggressive agency. Section 8, which is the provision to require a monthly turn-in of initiative petitions, is the first provision with which I have significant concerns. As a general matter, I support a monthly turn-in, provided that the sheets are retained as confidential by the Secretary of State until the signature-gathering process is complete. I agree that the verification process should be subject to public scrutiny, but I have concerns that making the sheets public very early in the process could result in harm to the integrity of the verification process. I think it's important to recognize that many of these petitions are circulated in a highly charged adversarial political climate, and I believe that it's incumbent on the Secretary of State to take as many reasonable precautions as possible to ensure the integrity of the process. I believe that includes keeping these petitions confidential until the measure is qualified or failed to qualify for the ballot. Section 9 allows chief petitioners to withdraw an initiative petition after turn-in. That strikes me as a very good provision in light of Measure 57 and 61, the negotiations that took place during 2008. Section 10, my read of it, basically codifies into law some provisions that are currently handled by administrative rule. I think that seemed fine. Section 11 establishes that the Secretary of State may not count signatures by someone who's been convicted of fraud or identity theft or has been subject to penalty under ORS 260.993 or ORS 260.995. I've circulated a summary of the provisions that are addressed in those two statutes, and the list appears fine to me with a couple of exceptions. ORS 260, 532, 6, and 8 appear to create a rule by which a successful private action against a petitioner can result in the petitioner being barred from circulating petitions. My main concern here would be that opponents of a measure could use this provision to disrupt the activities of legitimate circulators by using strategic lawsuits. The larger concern is that even minor violations may result in circulators getting banned from engaging in petitioning. ORS 260.995 pertains to an investigation under ORS 260.345, which is that any rule adopted by the Secretary of State under ORS Chapters 246 to 260 or any other matter preliminary to or relating to an election for which no penalty is otherwise provided. Campaign finance violations are addressed in ORS 259 and 260, so I believe the Secretary of State may have been in error when they said that, that the bill as written doesn't include campaign finance violations. I think that is the intent, and if it is the intent, they should just make the modifications they need to very clearly make that explicit. In summary, I think this is a good bill, and I believe the Secretary of State has taken a thoughtful and even-handed approach in the drafting of the bill. If the privacy concern that is addressed in Section 8 is addressed, and if there's greater clarification about what constitutes a violation under the provisions of the bill, I'd encourage support in passage. And I have supplemental documentation that I'd like to give you. If there are any questions, I'll be glad to answer them.
Thank you.
My name is Kathy Jackson. Members of the committee, Chair Roblin. I'm here, I guess, as the only person who's neither a lawyer nor a paid lobbyist for some organization or intending to be a chief petitioner or have been a chief petitioner. I'm the ordinary voter, fairly active in politics. And I would like to express the frustration of ordinary voters presented with petitions that it's become so toxic that most involved voters won't sign anything that they find on a street corner. I don't think it's the matter that we have, whether it's paid or unpaid, there's been so much press and so much fraud and so much negative cloud over the entire signature gathering process that as an engaged voter, I won't sign anything unless I know who I'm signing it. You know, if somebody hands it to me that I actually know in another context. And I think it's important to have that perspective in the work. And I think that this bill addresses many of those issues of how to separate the paid professionals who may or may not be being paid by signature or hour, I don't know, but to color code the petitions and to label them so that when somebody approaches me and I know based on what's on the petition sheet what I'm signing seems to me a step forward. Separating the paid and the unpaid petition seems to make sense to me because too often a petition for public power or some other or Mitch Greenlake's health care for all has been used as a cover sheet on top of a clipboard full of toxic other stuff that's being paid for by out-of-state money. I think that's a step in the right direction. I don't think that going online is a solution. The internet is not a secure place to sign petitions randomly. There's no way to verify anybody's identity. And there's enough identity theft out here. My husband and I have been notified 3 times in the last year that our data has been breached in various databases. And I don't want to have everybody who may have ever had a data breach or their purse stolen worry that somebody's going to go online and be able to pretend to be them and sign a signature. That's my concern. I've gone off script.
That's okay. We have
because I wanted to rant. I felt like ranting a little bit. I'm supportive of this as an ordinary citizen who feels that the integrity of the process is important and the transparency for the ordinary citizen to understand what is going on and what they may be asked to sign.
Thank you. Question, Representative Edwards.
Yeah, I just wanted to thank you for your testimony. Since you mentioned Representative Greenlake, I just wanted perhaps some clarification that Representative Greenlake wasn't out circulating all these other petitions with his house. I mean, you know, people are watching on TV and whatnot, so
Well, he had circulated several years ago. I know, Mitch.
Yeah, but you made reference to other toxic type
there
of
were other things on
initiatives
the things on the
that perhaps
board.
Somebody else that wasn't associated with him was. So
that's the real
I'm looking
issue
up for my good friend's name here. So.
No, the real issue is that there's worthwhile petitions like Mitch's or other worthwhile things that may be put on the clipboard as a cover for the toxic topics that Bill Sizemore or others may be, you know, we've been almost trained to salivate and say no to anything that certain people propose, and if you mix them, it confuses the ordinary voter, and is one of the reasons why it's there. I think that there's a move for professional signature gatherers because people just are really getting hardcore not saying yes to anything.
Any other questions? Thank you both. We're going to close the hearing on House Bill 2005. There will be a lot more discussion on this, folks, just so you know.
You want to go to the work session right now?
Yeah. I think I'm going to go to the work session. Yeah. There's some visitors we have on one bill, so I'm going to open a public hearing on H.G.R. 43. And we'll have a short explanation. And we can have our three people come up that are on this one.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Woodland. Members of the committee, H.J.R. 43 recognizes the importance of Oregon's small businesses to Oregon's economy. It resolves to recognize Oregon small businesses as stakeholders and key contributors to the economy with certain rights to be taken into account when considering and enacting legislation.
And with that, well, whoever wants to start.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Thank you for having us. I'm Chuck Jones. Just as a little bit of an introduction, I just realized I signed my first payroll check as a small business person 45 years ago this month. So I've been in small business a long while. I have small businesses in Portland. I'm a member of the Small Business Advisory Council of the City of Portland. excuse me, the Small Business Development Center Advisory, State Advisory Committee, and the NFIB Leadership Council. I thank you for considering adopting on a bipartisan basis, the Small Business Bill of Rights. And by the way, I would like you to possibly amend this so that it has the title of the Small Business Bill of Rights, so that somebody Googles Small Business Bill of Rights, it might come up. You'll understand why in just a minute. You're aware that small business is the engine of our economy in the state. And passing the Small Business Bill of Rights, you're acknowledging how important small business is to our state. This all started a few years ago when the state director of the Small Business Development Centers told me that the state of Maine had passed a Small Business Bill of Rights. I did some research and found out that the state of Maine was the only one at that time. Since then, Texas and Hawaii have also done so. Our federal house passed a Small Business Bill of Rights 2 years ago. They didn't get time to get through the Senate, but they also recognized the importance. Prior to bringing this to you, I introduced this through Portland Small Business Advisory Council to the city, and the SBAC members made numerous presentations to small businesses throughout Portland and to business organizations, and on November 29th of 2007, the city passed the city's Small Business Bill of Rights, and I believe you've been supplied a copy of that. Why is it even necessary to do this? Well, I think there are three main reasons. The first is front-of-mind awareness, so that the goose doesn't get killed accidentally. And these geese are obviously small business, without which we wouldn't have any state economy. Second, and frequently the unintended consequences without which there would, of such rules and regulations. I'll give you one example, and I'm sure you've heard it many times, of saying that all vehicles have to have a license unless they are only on private property and the poor farmer has pieces of land on both sides of the road. Unintended consequences. And third, reinforce that we are a small business friendly state. In addition, we hope it will again call to attention the importance of reducing state paperwork requirements of business, assisting small business access to state contracts, and entrepreneurship curriculums at community college. For example, Maine even put in a 311 business assistance line to make it easier for small business to get help. The passage of this sends a great message to everyone that not only is Portland open and becoming business friendly, that the entire state recognizes the importance of small business. I thank you for considering it and for so many of you sponsoring it.
Mr. Chair, committee members, thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of HJR 43, or otherwise known as the Small Business Bill of Rights. For the record, my name is Fred King, and I'm testifying today specifically as an individual and a small business owner who has been fortunate to run his own businesses in the state of Oregon for the last 35 years. I've had in the past the opportunity to serve on the Governor's Small Business Council and the Regional Economic Task Force. I'm a current member of the Oregon Small Business Advisory Council, the Tualatin Chamber of Commerce, the NFIB Leadership Council of Oregon, and the OSBRL Steering Committee, which is a co-sponsor between the NFIB and OSBRL, or co-sponsors of this bill. The importance of small business to our state is undeniable. In this economy, where we are experiencing 10.8% unemployment and an average of 680 job losses per day in the month of February, we have today an opportunity to recognize the importance of small business to Oregon and the eventual recovery of our economy. Small businesses account for 98% of the approximately 112,000 employer firms in Oregon. It has been said that small business is a heartbeat and driving economic force for our great nation, and will be the driving economic recovery force during these difficult times. This can equally be said for small business in the state of Oregon. HJR 43 identifies Oregon as a business-friendly state and specifically highlights the importance of pro-business objectives to the health of our great state. With the importance of small business to Oregon, the Small Business Bill of Rights distinguishes small business as a critical stakeholder to include when making rules, regulations, and laws. Our economy is simply too reliant on small business not to consider the adverse effects of making regulation, rules, and laws on the tens of thousands of small business owners in our state. We aren't asking to be treated differently, instead to consider small business owners as a stakeholder to the future of our state. A few specific pro-business objectives are highlighted in the Small Business Bill of Rights. With HJR 43, Oregon small businesses have a right to access to clear, stable, and predictable regulatory and record-keeping requirements, equal access to economic development tools, critical infrastructure services in the Oregon economy, including access to education and technical assistance in starting and operating a business, access to an economic culture that encourages and sustains the growth of small business. It is my belief that these objectives will help stimulate small business, the economy, and the state of Oregon. And HJR 43 has absolutely no negative fiscal impact on the budgetary constraints that you as legislators are currently facing. I appreciate the opportunity to speak before you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Oblin and members of the committee, thank you for giving us the time to address before you House Joint Resolution 43. I am Christine Chen Ryan, President of Synergy Consulting, Inc., since 1988 in Portland. I'm also Chair of the Oregon Small Business for Responsible Leadership, Chair of the Oregon Small Business Healthcare Initiative, former Chair of the Governor's Small Business Council, member of the Oregon Small Business Advisory Council, and a member of the League of Women Voters. I had to put that in previous. I also want to thank all of you for sponsoring this joint resolution. As Chuck said, he borrowed the concept from Maine and successfully advocated for it in Portland. We liked it so much, we, the OSBRL, that Tatiana Lifshitz, who couldn't be here because she was ill, she was scheduled to be here, rewrote it so that it does not have any fiscal impact, which I think is very good in this economic climate. I want to give a few high points of my written testimony. First of all, I want to give some statistics, and if you look at my written testimony in the second page, the third page has it in color, Oregon small businesses is defined in statute as less than 100 employees and account for 51% of private sector employees in Oregon. 98% of the approximately 112,203 employee firms in Oregon are small businesses. The 20 to 49 size class provides the largest number of small business jobs, which is 203,339. And you can look at the chart to get a little more statistics, which the source is also there from the OECD. The second thing is I'd like to tell you the purpose and meaning of House Joint Resolution 43 is to bring the small business up to equal status with the large businesses in Oregon, to recognize the key importance of business to the Oregon economy, to emphasize the earned right to equal access to economic development tools, such as equal consideration of the small business needs. Now, when I came here, I wanted to keep it short because I know it's Friday afternoon, you want to go home, and my testimony was really this much, but since then, I will give you an example because I think it's a very good recent example of why we think this is important. On March 24th, a letter from Blue Cross Blue Shield and the Americans Health Insurance Plans have sent to key senators working on the health reform on Capitol Hill in an effort to thwart federal government's efforts to create a nationally administered health insurance plan. In this letter, they offered to cut the rates to those with pre-existing conditions and stop refusing to insure sick people in order to insure the 48 million uninsured Americans. However, small businesses were specifically exempted from their offer to stop charging the sick higher premiums. This is what we mean when we say that small business is not being afforded equal access. We hope that with House Joint Resolution 43 in effect, Blue Cross Blue Shield will stop and think hard before deciding to treat small businesses with prejudice. House Joint Resolution 43 does not have fiscal impact, as Fred had mentioned. It is a philosophical declaration, and it calls attention to the notion that has been absent until now. The notion that is that small business must enjoy the same access to the economic tools. It is high time in the state of Oregon that we adopt this notion. Thank you for your time, Chair Roblin and members of the committee.
Thank you all. Any questions for these? Representative Burke?
No question, just a comment. I guess I'd like to thank these folks for bringing this forward as one of the sponsors, as I think every one of us are. I deeply appreciate your statistics as we move forward in an economic climate that is unprecedented and terrifying. I appreciate every person in this state who takes a risk and hires somebody else and employs them. We need you all, and as a former small business owner, I have deep and abiding appreciation for how scary it is out there every single day. And so thank you for bringing this forward. We need this reminder, and we need to remember we are a small business state. That's what we do here. So when we talk about business, you are putting the face on it, and thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for being here and testifying and presenting us with this bill. One of the reasons I chose to co-sponsor the bill and help these folks out with the introduction process was a deep feeling by myself, coming from small business myself, a company of about 25 employees, that in this global climate, as business and innovation has driven more and more advancement in society, the capital barriers, the automation, the innovation has shifted the business landscape more and more to the side of the big boys. And there is a different feeling. And you know, granted, a lot of the big boys are good places to work, but there is a sense of ownership and a sense of pride and a sense of family that exists in small businesses that just simply does not exist in so many of our big behemoth companies. And it is almost intangible, but it is very real. And if you've worked in that environment and been a part of that, you know what I'm talking about. And it is something that I fear we are losing. And so small business not only needs to be at the table, but needs to be especially considered as we move forward on tax policy and energy policy and healthcare policy and economic development policy and all these areas that you've brought forth. So thank you so much for working on this.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes.
I'd like to thank Representative Edwards for carrying this through. It was a big help, and thank you so much. Also being for a chief sponsor.
And thank you all for being here.
Thank you.
We're going to close our hearing on H.J.R. 43, and we're going to open a hearing. We're going to try to get as much as we can today on House Bill 2572. So we'll have a short explanation, and Representative, you can come up to the front.
Thank you.
It also appears we're going to have not get through all of our bills today, so we will be carrying them over. As if you didn't care that, I just wanted to make sure that people knew that. So.
Okay. I'm going to carry them over, John.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee. House Bill 2572 prohibits persons convicted of a criminal offense involving fraud, forgery, or identification theft, or convicted or found liable in criminal or civil action or proceeding under ORS 166.715 to 166.735 from serving as a chief petitioner of an initiative, referendum, or recall petition, or as an official associated with an entity paying persons to circulate petitions or on whose behalf petitions are being circulated. Declares an emergency, effective on passage.
Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jules Bailey, and I have the honor of representing House District 42, Inner East Side, Portland. And it's great to be back in front of what is apparently my favorite committee, testifying again. House Bill 2572 is the continuation of a conversation that began last legislative session about making sure that we are removing fraud and enforcing the law in our initiative system. This bill is about stronger consequences for those who violate the public trust in terms of forgery, identity theft, racketeering, and making sure that those who do violate the public trust have a timeout before they're able to access the system again. We're not trying to make the initiative system more difficult to access. We're trying to make it safer and protect it from those who would abuse the law. Now, as I mentioned, this is the continuation of a conversation, and House Bill 2572 is an entry point into that conversation. It will likely need some work, and I have spoken with the Secretary of State's office. They, I believe, will be testifying about some of their questions around the bill, around its administration. Want to make sure that this bill protects free speech and follows Oregon's Constitution and obviously the Constitution of the United States, and that we are making sure that we have the details worked out such that we're making sure that those who are prohibited from accessing the initiative system because they have been convicted or found liable for these crimes of trust are individuals who are receiving compensation for their work and not just, you know, citizens who are putting forward an initiative. So I'd love to take questions on it. I think it's a fairly simple concept. It takes the statute that was created last session by the Oregon legislature that defines those crimes, that limits them to initiative petition circulators, and expands that statute such that it applies not only to initiative petition circulators, but to those who ask those initiative petition circulators to go out and collect signatures. For those who have a desire to see something on the ballot, we ask that they be trustworthy, we ask that they follow the law, and we want to make sure that when Oregonians vote, they vote on something that's been brought to them in a way that is fair and legal.
I want to ask a question now, or you want to wait till...
No, I'd like to ask the representative how it is that I sit next to him every morning in revenue, and he told me that for that reason, that was his favorite committee.
Representative, Chair Representative Berger, you might note a theme in what my favorite committees are.
I might, since I sit across the room for you in transportation, too.
Right.
Representative Reblin.
Representative Gelser.
I also sit immediately on the other side of Representative Berger at our 8 o'clock hearing.
And it's your favorite committee.
I'm not going to comment on what my favorite committee is.
Mr. Chair. Oh, Representative Reed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I note that the other two committees that I serve on are also committees that Representative Bailey is on, so I'm just glad he's joined my third committee here, and perhaps we'll spend some more time here.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you'll note that I did not put stalking on the list of crimes.
Lifetime ban, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, if I could have one more comment, because it's 10 minutes to 5 and we're all tired and we're having a little fun here. I am anxiously awaiting a Courtney-esque discussion from our next testifier.
So with that, Representative Smith.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Jefferson Smith, for the record, State Representative, District 47. Here in support of House Bill 2572, I want to say at the outset that to the extent he will accept it, the lion's share, and indeed even more than that, of the credit for the good thing, any of the good thinking in this should belong to the person to my right. And I say this just because I haven't gotten a chance to say this on the record, and not merely to be a sycophant, but one of the more talented and creative thinking people I've had a chance to work with in any walk. The couple of things I wanted to offer to the conversation, because I know we're having a broader conversation about what we want to do about initiatives, and I think it's a really important conversation, I wanted to add two thoughts. First is about the origins and our sense of what we should preserve and thus what we should avoid cutting away from the initiative process. My own view of the initiative process is that it exists to be a check on unfettered power, and specifically, unfettered power as exercised by the legislature and the governor. If this body and our ability to accomplish lawmaking through the deliberative process of the legislature, if that is so captured by whatever interests that we have a hard time accomplishing things that are in the public interest, then it is a nice opportunity, or at least it's nice to have the opportunity to offer an escape valve for what otherwise might be a locked-up, captured process. I don't view, given my understanding of the current leadership of this legislative body, that the initiative process has any purpose in the current legislative scenario. But we should at least hold on to it for posterity. As I get the delayed laughter, it's sort of finally dawning on people. Of course, I think that any legislative body under any leadership is subject to the challenge of being able to accomplish things in the public interest based on some of the dynamics of our process, which is, as we would all acknowledge, imperfect. If we want to make sure that it remains a check on unfettered power, we need to make sure that the amendments we make to it, the changes we make to it, are those that don't make it more easy for big power to occupy that process, but instead make sure it is the check it was meant to be. One of the things I like very much about 2572 is that it is focused on paid signature gathering efforts, which, while I would certainly not say they are not legitimate places for us to participate in democracy, they aren't as much of the vehicle to be an escape valve for the public interest as a volunteer-driven effort. So I do think it's really important that we pay attention to the volunteer-driven portion of this. And beyond that, I wanted to say that about this bill, and also my compliment to the bill and to Representative Cobo-Bailey. And the last thing I wanted to say, it has to do with information costs.
Okay.
That in our zeal, which I think is important, to amend the initiative process, and this will probably be the only chance I have to chat with this committee about this set of issues. My own bias is that we shouldn't merely consider how high a fence we can build so that somebody trying to pass initiative has to get over that fence.
We have time.
And as we've heard from in a different arena, we build a 20-foot fence, and they can just build a 21-foot ladder. And all we will have done is make it harder for the scrappy do-gooders to get something done, and not necessarily any harder for the folks who would use this as merely one other mechanism to exercise otherwise unfettered power. To me, we should be focusing on initiative reforms that not only address fraud, which is important, but that also address information costs, making sure that people who engage in the signing of and even the voting on ballot initiatives have a greater sense of the outcomes of those ballot initiatives, that given the tool this offers is a less deliberative tool and a less deliberative process, is that we need to pay down those information costs, whether it's through a jury system that I've heard proposed, whether it's through some sort of legislative review, whether it's through some sort of fiscal review, but something to pay down those information costs, and that in our zeal to address the fraud, we not miss the information cost challenge, which I actually think is by far the bigger problem. No matter how big a fence that we build, will we be able to be sure somebody doesn't build a higher ladder? But if we don't provide the information that's necessary or figure that out, we'll keep getting ballot initiatives with unintended consequences as long as we live, and otherwise I will shut up.
I'm certain that the kind of moment that Representative Berger wanted did happen.
No, it did quite intentionally or unintentionally, but I had two things to say, and I will save up some enjoyable moment for some other time. I apologize for not entertaining anyone in the room, and that's probably not to the detriment of democracy.
Any questions for these witnesses? Thank you very much. We have three more witnesses for this one that I will take, and I know that when 5 o'clock some people have to get going. We have two other bills, and so I'll wait till it. So we'll call Kathy Eaton, Barry Pack, and Dan Meek up for this bill. And just to announce while they're coming up, make sure I get the right names. House Bill 30, 33, and 2941 will be carried over to Monday. And we'll put them on the Monday deal. We'll start going down that long list. And a few of those are going to get carried over as well. Those will start at the top. We'll put these at the top. People waited long enough. They get to go first. So with that, I guess we can start with Kathy.
All right. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kathy Eaton. I'm the governance coordinator for the League of Women Voters, and I'm going to be very brief. We support House Bill 2572 because we believe that the initiative process should be protected from fraud and misuse. Direct democracy is an important avenue for citizens to propose legislation in the best interests of all Oregonians, and we need to make it as open as possible and have the ability to discuss it as openly as possible and not take away from citizens their ability to feel that the system is being used, misused. And we feel that in order to provide for a fair and fraud-free initiative system, we recommend that the committee support House Bill 2572. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Pack.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Barry Pack, Deputy Secretary of State. I will also be brief. We just wanted to raise a couple of questions, I think, if the committee were interested in working with this bill and moving it forward, that would need to be addressed. In looking at the bill, there are some... It's unclear exactly how we would be proceeding. My assumption, and I did talk with Representative Bailey earlier today, is that his intent was that we would run a background check, as we do for signature gatherers, on chief petitioners at the time at which the chief petitioners are named. What's also unclear is if we find that a chief petitioner, and those chief petitioners are named after the sponsorship signatures are turned in, and we begin the verification process of those signatures for that then to become a prospective initiative to go on out there. If we ran a background check at that point and found that one of the named chief petitioners had been convicted of one of these crimes, what do we do with the signatures that were turned in at that time? Are they invalidated? Do they need to start over again? Do they need to replace the chief petitioner? We would like to have some direction and some clarity around that. And then it's also unclear if what would happen if after the chief petitioners were run through a background check, let's say it came out clear there were no convictions, but what if the Elections Division were to become aware down the road that someone was convicted, one of those chief petitioners were convicted of one of these crimes, and it's in the midst of signature gathering for an initiative, what would we do at that point? Do we stop the gathering of signatures? These are questions that we'd want to have addressed and some clarity in the bill.
Thank you. Mr. Meek.
My name is Dan Meek. I'm a public interest attorney. I represent several groups that use the initiative process. The statement that this bill needs work, I think, is correct. It applies not just to chief petitioners, but to anyone who serves as any kind of an officer associated with any number of things, anything you can possibly say is an entity, a club, an organization, an entity, that is paying people to circulate petitions or on whose behalf petitions are being circulated. It's very vague. Now, the Secretary of State's office just asked, what is the consequence of a violation of this? And there's no consequence specified here, but Representative Bailey stated that this expands the statute that applies to initiative petition circulators. That is, you can't be a criminal and circulate petitions, certain kind of criminal. The consequence in that bill, which of course is HB 2082 from the last session, was that the signature sheets don't count. So I assume that that's what they mean here, the signature sheets don't count. Well, let's look at a couple of scenarios. Let's say that a club is formed called Oregonians for Campaign Finance Reform. And let's say that they're paying for circulate. They are paying circulators. Let's say, you know, they're a political committee or whatever. They're an entity. All it could be is an entity. And let's say we have meetings all over the place, and someone says, well, you know, I'd kind of like to be outreach director for your club. Well, what are you going to do? Say, sorry, we have to do a criminal background check on you, because if you are a certain type of criminal, you deep six, you torpedo our measure. Even if we've collected 200,000, 300,000 signatures, you torpedo our measure. So that means no one can serve as any kind of an officer or official of a club involved in the initiative process without having a background check done on them. And, of course, there's no mechanism for background checks to get done. Even if the background check gets done, let's say that the police record misses something. Well, then you still get your ballot measure disqualified 6 months, a year down the road because the police record isn't complete. Okay? Scenario number two. Someone forms a new group and calls it More Oregonians for Campaign Finance Reform. It has nothing to do with the first group, but it says we're out there. We like this petition. This is a great petition. Please sign this petition. Okay. Well, is that a club on whose behalf the petitions are being circulated? Could be. It's an organization that's advocating for the petition. In that case, anyone can set up a phony organization, recruit a identity thief from Pennsylvania, and deep six any petition simply by forming a club that has as an official someone who's been convicted of fraud, forgery, or identity theft in other states. It kind of makes a market combats unemployment by former fraud criminals. The other part of this bill, let's just make clear what it's about. It applies to anyone who's convicted or found liable in a criminal or civil action or proceeding under ORS 166.715-735. That's Oregon's racketeering statute. So that essentially applies to Bill Sizemore and no one else at this point, and probably no one else for a long period of time. But as I say, it needs work.
Thank you. Any questions for these witnesses?
Yep.
Representative Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To Dan, thanks for your testimony. Do you support the kind of general concept, but this needs a lot of work, or do you actually not support the general concept, or the two so intertwined that you just can't really separate them?
Representative Edwards, I would support the general concept applied to chief petitioners, but this goes way beyond that. This applies to any club, and I would certainly remove the phrase "or on whose behalf petitions are being circulated," because that's too vague. And once again, whenever you have vagueness in a statute like this, it is a means for intimidation. It is a means for supporters of a measure to be intimidated into abandoning their measure. So I think these statutes should be extremely carefully worded so that the average person can understand them and cannot be intimidated on the basis of them.
Other questions? Seeing none, I thank you all three. And we will close our public hearing on House Bill 2572. That means, again, House Bill 3033 and 2941 will be held over to the Monday. And, yes, we have about eight on that day, too.
I can only find House Bill 3033 on here.
3033.
That's the only bill that's being held over, correct?
What about 2941? We heard just a little bit of it. We didn't finish the hearing. We only heard it from the two representatives.
I'm sorry. I thought we heard that.
No. Well, there's one or two other people that need to.
You opened and closed it.
Yeah, we opened and closed it. So, and we'll put it in that order on that day so that people who have waited so long, and we appreciate all the testimony of the people that have come today. I think we do have a lot of work ahead of us with respect to these bills. So, again, thank you, and we're going to close our rules hearing.